Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Well, today the minimum wage goes up 70 cents. We will be getting into that in some depth in our second hour. In our third hour, Daniel Bliss taking our country back, one of our candidates. The national speed limit, this is a big discussion. Should we reduce the speed limit to 55 in order to save fuel? We'll get into that. But right now, Don Corus is with us. He's a successful real estate developer and businessman for more than 25 years. And author of a new book, Government Pirates, and the subtitle of his book, The Assault on Private Property Rights and How We Can Fight It. Don, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you.
You know, private property rights were burned into the founding of this country. John Locke, in his second treatise on government back in 1758, I think it was, wrote about life, liberty, and estate. In other words, life, liberty, and the right to private property, which is a radical idea at that time. Excuse me, 1658, which was a radical idea at that time because the king owned everything. By the time the founders came along, it was pretty much a given. I mean, Jefferson replaced estate with happiness because it was just a given. Private property was a given. Although the Fifth Amendment does say that the government, for the benefit of the public good, can take our private property, but they must compensate us appropriately. The Supreme Court since then has come up with a very different interpretation of that. I suspect you being a conservative, me being a liberal, in both of our opinions. You want to riff on that for a minute?
Absolutely. And what you refer to in the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment, basically states, quote, nor shall private property be taken for public use, which are two key words, public use, without just compensation.
Right.
And the Supreme Court decision that you referred to is the New London, Connecticut versus Kelo versus New London, Connecticut. And that's one of the things, one of the reasons that inspired this book, Tom. When I read that decision, I was outraged. And even as a developer who's developed property from Texas, California, and Florida, where I now currently reside, I was outraged because of we should not give the power to local government. And essentially what that decision did was that the city of New London was able to essentially transfer its powers of eminent domain to be able to seize private property for the sake of generating tax revenues.
Yeah, well, let's take it beyond that. I mean, that was the rationale. That was what they used as the rationale. They say, okay, we've got a couple of little mom-and-pop stores here in a slowly growing area. Let's blow them out of the water, put in a Walmart. That's going to make more tax revenue for us. That's the public good. And but it was basically replacing one corporation with another. I agree with the right of a local government to create a park, to put in a fire department or a police department and use eminent domain to do that. I mean, they have to be able to do that.
Absolutely.
But to say, hey, this corporation is going to generate a better tax base than that corporation, yep, that's where, in my mind, it just goes completely over the top.
Absolutely, and that's where we can agree. I mean, the case up there was just fraught with all kinds of corruption. Pfizer, the pharmaceutical company, who are the makers of Viagra, came in, cut a deal with the city, and the city sold them land, very valuable land, for $10, exempt them from taxation for 10 years, and helped them get federal and state assistance for $118 million.
Right.
And then all the other properties that were acquired by virtue of eminent domain guess what's happened to them? Everything's been bulldozed, and it just sits as an open field. Nothing has happened. And unfortunately, this goes on throughout America.
Right, and this is the kind of thing, oddly enough, John Roberts, a big supporter of this Supreme Court decision. Of course, he made $2 million a year as a lawyer for corporations before he was made Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. What we find, although he wasn't on the court at the time of the decision, what we find is that, frankly, in my opinion, this is moving us in that direction of the classic definition of fascism, which is the merging of corporate and state interests. Let's keep the state providing us with our fire protection and our police protection, and arguably we can extend the commons to things like schools and roads and post offices, and the right of eminent domain is entirely appropriate in those cases. But when the state starts messing in corporate affairs, in business affairs, and micromanaging economies like this, which, by the way, also puts us into the realm of the states, I think it should be against the law for states to offer tax incentives to move into their communities. Because what we have is, Boeing was playing three cities off each other saying, who's going to give us the best deal when we decide to move our headquarters? And who ends up paying the tab? You and me. The taxpayers get screwed.
I agree with you 100%.
So why then, your book, Government Pirates, the Assault on Private Property Rights and How We Can Fight It, we're talking with Don Corace. His website, by the way, Don Corace, C-O-R-A-C-E.com. Why then the tone of the book? I mean, throughout your book, it is basically a whole series of anecdotes about, government bad. This person got screwed, and certainly in any kind of situation, you're going to find a lot of anecdotal stuff, and also you're taking on even the commons. I mean, for example, your chapter on the spotted owl, which is real familiar to those of us who live here in the Pacific Northwest. The spotted owl is an indicator species. It wasn't just one owl. It was like that's the species that tells you whether the entire ecosystem is collapsing or not, or whether it's healthy. And you're saying essentially in this book that the government has no business protecting an ecosystem, but our survival as human beings depends on a living ecosystem around us.
I don't say that in the book. Basically, in the instance that you refer to, the spotted owl, what happened in that particular instance is that you have a property owner who's trying to harvest lumber on his property, and this is a mom and pop. This isn't Weyerhaeuser. This is a small family that's trying to subsist on their lumber inventory. What happened to these people, and what has happened to several small property owners out there, is that these restrictions that are put on as a result of the Endangered Species Act, for all intents and purposes, have taken their property, although these people have the privilege to pay taxes. I'm not saying by any means.
But see, they're not paying taxes on its value for the lumber that can be removed from it because they can't remove the lumber. They're paying their taxes on its value as raw land.
On property that they can't remove the lumber on as well.
But what right, my point.
What I'm saying in the book, Tom, is that there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to come up with a plan to protect threatened and endangered species.
We have the 70-mile exclusion zone, and their property was within that, as you point out in your book. And what's wrong with that? If you're going to protect us, not just a species, but actually an entire ecosystem.
Well, let me ask you this: is that for a public use?
Yes, because we all. If you don't have a healthy ecosystem, particularly in the forests of the Pacific Northwest, I am answering your question, Don. If you don't have a healthy ecosystem in these mountainous areas where the rain comes and it goes down the mountains, that healthy living ecosystem is the kidneys of this area. We drink the water when it hits the rivers. We need to have healthy forests out here if we're going to have decent water and we've got some of the best water in the world here in Portland, Oregon.
For example, that is for public use, is it not?
Yes.
Okay. Now, let's go back to the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation.
Their private property was not taken.
Why don't these people get compensated?
Because their private property wasn't taken. This is the equivalent of zoning.
It was taken.
No, it wasn't. They still own that property.
They can't use it. They can't.
That's right. Just like if you live next door to me, you can't build a toxic waste plant if I say, hey, no, I really don't want a toxic waste plant. If the neighborhood says no.
That's apples and oranges, Tom.
No. What you're arguing against, Don, is democracy.
What I'm arguing is democracy? No,
yes.
What I'm arguing is...
What you're arguing here in a democratic...
capitalism.
No, we have a constitutionally limited democratic republic, and our representatives representing the majority of us said, yes, we want to protect these ecosystems, so we're going to impose zoning laws. Just like a local community could say, yes, we don't want a toxic waste plant in our community. Is that taking? If I say that you can't build a toxic waste plant on your property, is that taking your property?
No, that's a different circumstance. But
how?
If it's for a public use, Tom, if it's for a public use, don't you, how would you?
No, a private toxic waste plant. No,
I'm not talking about a toxic waste plant. I'm getting back to the spotted owl issue.
I'm saying it's all the same thing. This is essentially zoning.
Yes, it's zoning, but if you take somebody's property for the sake of...
But zoning isn't taking, it's regulating.
Yes, exactly. And if you regulate somebody's property to the extent that those regulations are onerous and affect the economic viability of that homeowner, or actually takes property because you can't use it, the government should compensate the property owner.
Yeah, see, I think that's as much of a stretch as the Supreme Court decision.
I'm really surprised, Tom, that you're opposed to the Kelo situation, but on an endangered species issue, it's okay.
Yeah, I guess that's where we separate. Don Corace, Corace, .com, the website. Don, thanks for being here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour, a program brought to you in part by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, particularly our local sponsors, well, also our national sponsors as well, but in particular, our local radio stations need your support. Let them know that you're listening. Let them know if you like the show, and let their advertisers, let their sponsors know that you're buying their products or you're recommending their products and you've heard their ads. This is really important stuff. Plus, our program brought to you in part by the Teamsters Union, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. You can find out more about that at teamster.org. So here we have this ongoing debate about the commons. What is the commons? At what point do we say, yes, we're here to protect the commons? I mean, the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, in addition to guaranteeing your right against self-incriminating testimony, also says that if your property is being taken by the government to serve the public good, in other words, to become part of the commons, the government is our commons, if it's taken from you, you shall be appropriately and justly compensated. Well, there's another dimension to this as well. I mean, there's the whole issue of public lands and public parks and should be, for example, T. Boone Pickens, he's building this huge wind farm out in Texas. And the state of Texas just voted to build transmission lines so he can sell his power. Who's going to pay for those transmission lines? I have a feeling it's going to be the taxpayers of Texas. And they're going to be taking people's land by eminent domain. Why? So T. Boone Pickens can make millions of dollars. But he's making millions of dollars in a way that is arguably helping the public good. Should it be public power in Texas? Should it be private power? You know, you can get in that whole thing. Another part of the commons, the freeways. Our freeway, the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System, you know, when it was first developed, speed limits were 55 miles an hour in some places. In other places, there were no speed limits. Nevada was famous for having no speed limits. And so, you know, can you drive 55? There's actually a proposal now. John Warner, the Republican from Virginia, has asked the Energy Information Administration to study the possibility of a new national speed limit. Best guess is we'll save between 1 and 3% of our gasoline if we had a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. Doesn't mean people are going to drive 55. I remember when we had a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, everybody drove 64 miles an hour. Just like right now with a 65-mile-an-hour speed limit, people drive 74 miles an hour. Or with a 70-mile-an-hour speed limit, people drive 79 miles an hour. But nonetheless, they've slowed down. They slow down a bit. And, is that, worth 1% to 3%? We've actually seen almost a 3% drop in gasoline over last year. So would you be willing to support a national speed limit of 55 miles an hour? Or would you consider that a government taking of sorts, a taking of liberties, a taking of freedom to speed like crazy? Should we do like Germany did with the Autobahn and just say, hey, you can go as fast as you want on the highways? Problem is that it's really hard to get a driver's license in Germany. You've got to really demonstrate proficiency. I mean, it's really hard. And I remember when we lived in Germany seeing cops walk up to cars with a ruler in their hand and sticking it in the tread of the tires to make sure that there was at least a quarter inch of tread. And if the car didn't have that quarter inch of tread, they'd impound the car right there. I mean, it was incredible. And so, you know, so you'd have these 55 car pileups on the Autobahn. And I've not ever been in one, but I have seen them. I was at the tail end of one once. It was over 100 cars got smashed because everybody's going 100 miles an hour. I was too. But nobody died. I mean, people do die from time to time, but it wasn't anything near what a 100 car pileup in the United States would be. Because the cars are very, very well built, very solid, and they get very good gas mileage, oddly enough. Maybe it's because they don't have so many SUVs, so many giant tanks running into other cars and squishing people like a bug. I don't know. But I can tell you that their rate of deaths was lower. On the other hand, there's parts of the Autobahn where they've regulated the speed limit. And I think actually recently they've started to regulate the speed limits on the Autobahn. It's been a while since I've driven on the German Autobahn, so I frankly can't tell you from personal experience. But should we lower our speed limit to 55? I mean, there's a whole spectrum of issues here that have to do with eminent domain and how far government power should extend and what is the public good and how do we do it. And I'm frankly in favor of a national 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. And the fact of the matter is that the federal government can't impose – by the way, this is how it works. The federal government can't impose a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit nationally. They can't. They don't have the power to do that. The Constitution gives that power to the states in the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, and the people of the states. And so, the way the federal government does it is they say, well, if you want federal highway funds, if you want federal matching funds for to build highways and fix your roads and things like that, you've got to have a 55 mile an hour speed limit. And if your speed limit goes higher than that, you don't get the federal funds. That's how the federal government does this. So it's really not a mandate. It's not a we're going to shove this down your throat. It's more like a, hey, you want the money? This is what you got to do. And the people in the states could say, no, we don't want the money. We'll pay higher taxes. We'll increase our gas tax here in the state of Oregon, for example, by 10 cents and put our speed limit at 90 miles an hour. And, we don't need no federal funds. We can create our own funds. We'll do it however we want. So, we'll see. T. Boone Pickens, by the way, going to be on the show on Monday. We'll ask him, who's going to pay to get your power to market? Who should be owning public power? 866-303-2270. Lot to talk about when it comes to the commons. We'll be right back with your calls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call us at 866-303-2270.
Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry. Cause I always wanted me one that was long and black. One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man. I'd sneak it out of there in a lunchbox in my hand. Now getting caught meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the time I retired. I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000. I'd get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime.
So that's how the conservatives are taking our country. One piece at a time. Oh, let's privatize the roads. Let's privatize the water system. Let's privatize the electric system. Let's privatize the schools. Pretty soon they're going to be privatizing the fire departments and the police departments. Oh, my. So where does the commons begin and end, and what are the appropriate limits of it, and how do we do this, and how do we handle this, and how do we deal with this fuel crisis, and on and on and on. Public domain, eminent domain. Richard in Studio City, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Richard.
How you doing?
Good.
What's up? My point is, your guest seems very concerned that when the community does something that decreases the economic value of their property, that they be compensated.
Right.
My point is, well, shouldn't it work the other way by that logic? If the community builds roads, parks, health care that increases the property value, shouldn't they give us, the community, the increase?
Actually, they do. Their property taxes go up.
But not the entire increase. Their property taxes would go down through the economic, quote-unquote, damage, because the value of that property would go down and could be reassessed down.
Right. That was my point. What I was saying, you know, first of all, if you own some land and a highway goes through and they put an off-ramp there, there have been a few politicians who've been successful in making that kind of thing happen, the value of the property goes up, but the property taxes go up because the value of the property's gone up. So, but on the other hand, if you own land that has, you know, trees on it that have great value, but there's no way you can log them, they cannot, you know, you can't justify a property tax based on the value of the trees because they can't be taken. So there's no value there. So you pay taxes on the land as if it was just land, you know. I agree with you. I think Corus is inconsistent on that. I don't think that that's taking. So, you know, excellent point, Richard. Let's see here. Lewis in Portland on KPOJ. Hey, Lewis.
Well, Tom, I've got to say that your libertarianism is being inconsistent on that case. That's a taking.
My libertarianism? I am not a libertarian. I'm a liberal.
Okay. All right. Well, I would say that that's an inverse taking. Is if I have my apple trees and are about ready to harvest a crop, and you come out and say, well, no, we're not going to allow you to harvest your crop this year, then you've taken my economic livelihood. And similarly, if you're a tree farmer, that's what happens. And I think there needs to be some kind of consideration. Now,
yeah, I don't disagree with you if somebody was a tree farmer. But if somebody has some land that has been, and we're talking about old growth forest here, which means it's never been logged ever. And if somebody has some land and they've been living on it and they decide, hey, I'm going to convert, and I can speak as a former landowner. We used to own a whole bunch of acreage in Vermont and we logged it actually. In fact, we had a guy come in with horses, to do, you know, little damage, you know, actually to try and help make the forest healthier. And we had 400 acres when we lived in Vermont, and it was, you know, there's a whole art and science to it if you're going to do it right, as opposed to just, you know, stripping it. But in any case, if you simply have that land, if you, you know, bought it to live on it or whatever, and you can't take the trees out, I don't see the problem.
Well, that's a different thing. Is why you own the land and what your historical use was. That's another thing. But why I called was, here in Oregon, we passed, in response to that Supreme Court case, we passed a constitutional amendment that prevents government entities from using eminent domain to pass along to a private developer.
Right.
And I'm in that kind of business,
and then we passed another measure that did away with the weirdnesses of the First Amendment measure.
No, I think, you know, no, we didn't. This one only passed 2 years ago and hasn't been a change. It prevents.
Okay, then we're talking about two different measures.
Yeah, if we can no longer have eminent domain to pass along to commercial developers.
Mm-hmm.
And the downside to that is it's too much of a blanket story, because I've worked on a project where we have seven property owners. And six want to sell, and the seventh doesn't want to sell. And the seventh doesn't want to sell not because of economics. They just don't want to sell. Now, it's not their home we're talking about. It's a commercial enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have here is, and it's kind of what we call a linchpin. I mean, they're in a strip between the other six property owners, so you can't
right.
just develop the six. You've got to have all.
Right. And eminent domain now cannot be used because of that constitutional amendment.
And the problem comes in is that we're talking about, in part of this project is a relatively large park. It's a common. So I mean, this is a combination commercial development, housing, low-income housing development, and commons project. You know, probably total cost is $120 million. It's not going to happen because somebody doesn't want to sell $400,000 of the property. The constitutional amendment should have said something like this. We can't do that, but unless you want to pay 200 times the market value.
Yeah, there should have been some kind of rational limit.
Right, should have been.
Yeah, Lewis, I get your point, and we're starting to talk about the minutia of Oregon law. So, but point taken. I need to move along though, and let a few other folks in here on this, and Peter in Blaine, Washington. Hey, Peter.
Yeah, hi Tom. This is about your idea about the 55 mile an hour.
Yeah, it's not mine. It's the Republican from Virginia, John Warner.
Right. Well, a lot of people, I think, are thinking about it. But in any case, I live up here in Blaine, which is on the Canadian border, and I frequently drive between here and Bellingham, which is about 20 miles south on I-5. And 6 months ago, I would get on the freeway and set my cruise control. The cruise control. Yeah, it's 70 miles an hour and just cruise along. And lately, I've been setting it on 60 miles an hour, and I noticed that a lot of other people on the road are doing exactly the same thing. In other words, not that many people are passing me as I'm cruising along in the right.
Yeah, people are slowing down to save gas. Good point. So, you know, the other thing that this brings up, and thank you for pointing that out, Peter. The other thing that this brings up is that in the United States, cars are optimized; they're designed to have optimal gas efficiency at 55 miles an hour. Why? Because the sticker on the side of the car when you buy it that says what the highway gas mileage is, those tests that are done to define the highway gas mileage are done at 55 miles an hour. So the car is optimized. It's designed to get maximum fuel efficiency at 55 miles an hour. Another way to get at this would be to say that the highway gas mileage that is advertised on a car has to be the highway gas mileage at 65 miles an hour. Then car manufacturers would redesign engines and transmissions so that the maximum efficiency point, the point of the curve of maximum efficiency would be 65 miles an hour rather than 55 miles an hour, as it probably is in Europe. I don't know, but that's another way to do it. Jerry in Tennessee. Hey, Jerry. You're on the air, Jerry. Jerry? No, Jerry. Okay, Rob in Minnesota. Minnesota. Hey, Rob.
I'm out there for you, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
It's where I'm a truck driver, and the whole thing is where if you slow down the speed limits, do you want to pay more for your everything that you get? It's where, yes, you will save the fuel, but the whole thing is where I've got to work longer to be able to get it there.
Right, but and you should be paid more for that. You know, it's or you know, if instead of expecting you to get from point A to point B in 9 hours, they now allow you 12 hours, and
no,
they pay you for that.
300-mile run is where at 65 miles an hour it takes me 20 hours.
Right, but here's the question, Rob: is if you have to be paid extra, if there's an extra labor cost because it's going to take more time. Have we reached the point with fuel costs where if you save, say, 5% on your fuel, but you're paying an extra 5% on your labor, that it washes or that it might actually even be cheaper because labor is now a smaller component of transportation than fuel costs?
Well, excuse me. If I have to work longer to be able to take and go from A to B, it's where I should be paid more. But the whole
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying you should be paid more. So if you're paid more and you're using less gas, and so you're paying less for the gas, but you're paying more for the salary. What doesn't that just wash?
You know, it's a washout. I got to ask you one question, please.
Sure.
It's off subject. I'm only through the first third of Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine.
Yeah, it's a great book.
It's unbelievable. It's the scariest book since I read Stephen King.
Yeah.
You verify or validate all of her claims in the
first
third of the book.
That book has been vetted 16 ways to Sunday. Naomi Klein is absolutely one of the most solid journalists in America, and Shock Doctrine is one of the best books out there, and every American should read it.
Oh, it's where America has to be able to read that, because, I mean, we're in for it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's another one, the other Naomi, the two Naomis I refer to them. Naomi Wolf wrote a book called The End of America, which is a very short book. I think it's less than 100 pages about how the Bush administration is destroying the Constitution and ripping apart our freedoms. And you lay these two books side to side and you get this, just real eye popping picture of what's going on in America. And, I'll tell you, Rob, it is.
How about Chalmers Johnson nemesis?
I beg your pardon?
Chalmers Johnson Nemesis?
Chalmers Johnson Nemesis?
Yeah, I mean, that's his book, too. You know, I mean, I just...
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. I know who I haven't read that book, but Chalmers Johnson.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
You talk about detail, the way that things are going in America,
yep.
And the way our government is working things.
Yeah, he's a great writer. Rob, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And you know, keep on trucking there. It's good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio. Stick around. 866-303-2270. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at hartmanradio.com.
Before the hour. Downright dizzy, I'm telling you. That's what Giuliani is making me. Let's see, when he was running for president, he said, I am a big proponent of tort reform and for holding people accountable for the lawsuits they file. No one should underestimate the damage done by out-of-control lawsuits. Well, his son, who was just kicked off the Duke University golf team, for unsportsmanlike conduct, he threw and broke his clubs when he got mad, is suing Duke University. Yeah. Rudy's teaching him well, or teaching him good, or whatever. That and Duncan Hunter, I mean, this is our go ahead and make my day here. It's
go ahead. Make my day.
Yeah, Duncan Hunter. Duncan Hunter says, yeah, he'll go to the U.S. Embassy in Chad to see whether the food is being distributed at the refugee camp. However, only under one condition. He's got to be able to shoot some wildebeest. Yeah. Only problem, there's no wildebeest in Chad. Sorry. Doesn't have any. And the GOC does not allow the hunting of large mammals. You know, the government of Chad doesn't permit the hunting of large mammals. So Duncan Hunter, sorry, you can't go over there and kill things for fun. Sad. Kim in San Francisco. Hey Kim, what's up?
Hey Tom, I need to ask you a question. I want to say that I listen to your show mostly because you educate me, and I appreciate that. And I also want to say I listen to a lot of the shows, and in your particular case, your absence of vanity and ego is why I learn from you. And I just want to thank you for how you are able to check that at the door, and I will never stop listening to you because of
that. Thank you,
Kim.
And by the way, you just reminded me, yesterday when we were talking about fingerprinting for people getting mortgages, I was wrong. It and my guest, kind of let me go along with this. I'm baffled as to why. The mortgage loan originators, the people writing the mortgages, the employees, the frontline employees, the minimum wage clerk at the front desk of the mortgage company, they're the ones who have to get fingerprinted, not the people actually getting the mortgages. I just want to correct that on the air. Anyhow, you had a question.
Okay. Is it fair to say that privatization causes taxpayers to finance projects that only profit investors? Am I right?
To some extent, yeah. It depends on the project, and it depends on how extensively it's privatized. The worst kinds are the private-public partnerships, where that's very much the case. I mean, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are great examples of that.
Okay, so I'm just trying to find a succinct way of explaining it to my friends. I mean, like, you know, bumper sticker stuff. Is there a way to do this that's so clear and short?
Yeah, privatization is when they steal our collective stuff and say, now I own this, and I get to make a profit off it. You know, a great example is highways. In Illinois and Indiana, you know, selling off highways to private companies based in Spain, and then they put up toll roads and say, you want to use this road, you have to pay the toll, and by the way, we're going to take the profit back to Spain.
Is that what T. Boone is doing?
Well, we'll find out on Monday, but I can virtually guarantee you there's a good chunk of this being a private-public thing, that the public is probably going to be paying for the transmission lines, and T. Boone will be generating the electricity. I think that's the bill that just passed in Texas. I haven't read it. It's, you know, it's a huge piece of legislation.
Yeah, he ain't dumb, is he?
No, he's not dumb. He's going to figure out a way to make some money on it. Kim, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Jerry in Tennessee, let's try this again, Jerry.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
First of all, Tom, I'd like to say that I listen to your show all the time. I listen to it when I had XM, and now that I'm on Sirius, I get to listen to you every day.
Great.
What I'm calling about is the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit.
Yeah.
I understand, like the one caller said, that he cut his truck back to 60 mile an hour, and he runs from point A to point B and back same route every day, I assume.
Right.
And I'm an over the road. I have a lot more distance to travel usually, and if I cut back to 55, it's going to cut back on my mileage.
Yeah, yeah.
And if my mileage is cut back, a load that I could take out and deliver in 10 or 11 hours at a decent rate of speed, I don't mean flying down the road, but at a decent rate of speed, if I'm cut to 55, then there's going to be a break in there, a 10-hour break.
Yeah, no, I understand and there. I agree with all that. I think that you should be paid more for your time. I think we need to be re-regulating the trucking industry. I mean, the deregulation of the trucking industry has just cost and, you know, is wiping out independent truckers and now, you know, opening the border and saying Mexican truck drivers can bring their rigs into the United States and drive all the way to Washington, D.C. I mean, this is crazy. This is Reaganomics run.
They're not going to do that, though. They're, you know, these companies, seriously, they're going to be looking at, they're going to be making up a profit that they were losing to start with, and they're not going to come back on us and give us more money until way on down the line, and that's not going to help us in the short term.
Yeah, no, I agree, and that's why I would require, you know, if Congress is going to do something like increasing or decreasing the speed limit, they also need to do something to help independent truckers. And,
yeah, they really need to look at that, and it's generally not looked at. You know,
you're right.
The people that are driving their cars up and down the highway, but the freight still has to get to its destination. And if it can't get to its destination on time, then the factory is going to be waiting on the product before they can start their lines back up, or the stores are going to be waiting on the product to get there late. You know,
well, everything will just recalibrate itself. I mean, if everything takes just a little bit longer to get there, it'll work its way through the system. I mean, we went through this before in this country, and it wasn't a crisis when we went to a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. But back then, most of the trucking industry was regulated. And so you knew, I'm going to have to drive a little longer, but I'm going to get paid for it. You know,
right.
And that's the problem.
Right.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. I gotta move along. It's the end of the hour. And by the way, the last time we were talking about trucking and long-haul trucking, I mentioned that I was always curious about that subculture. Richard Ide sent me his novel, Three Aces, which I just finished reading like a couple weeks ago. It took me a long time. It takes me a long time to do recreational reading because I'm writing a book right now. It's a great book. You can the number three, acesthenovel.com. Check it out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So do we have an economy for us? Or do we have an economy for them? Typically, them is, you know, some other. In this case, the other being that 1% of Americans who earn more than $400,000 a year, $460,000 a year, which in the top 1%. If today, and the reason I bring this up, and the reason I'm framing it this way, is because today is the day that the minimum wage is going up. And I am trying to find, here it is. It's going up 70 cents from $5.85 last year to $6.55 this year. Next year, it'll go up to $7.25. the federal minimum wage. And now many states, here in Oregon, for example, we already have, I think it's $7.25 minimum wage. Our minimum wage is higher than the federal. And, in fact, when our minimum wage went up above the federal minimum wage, as it has done several times, it increased the prosperity of our state. Contrary to the claims that have been made by conservatives since the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt put into place the first minimum wage back in 1938. And in 1940, 2 years later, he was being hammered by right-wingers for his putting into place a federal minimum wage. And he said, you know, we cannot back away from this. He said, in fact, you know, and this was before we'd entered World War II. He said, our military strength, our, you know, as our strength as a nation is dependent upon our strength, our economic strength as a people. We were coming out of the Great Depression as a result of the New Deal policies. And he said, we can't back away. Here's Franklin Roosevelt on this topic. From this, by the way, from a fireside chat in 1940. Oh, hang on just a second. Helps if we can plug in the wires.
While our Navy and our airplanes and our guns and our ships may be our first lines of defense, it is still clear that way down at the bottom, underlying them all, giving them their strength, sustenance, and power, are the spirit and the morale of a free people. For that reason, we must make sure in all that we do that there be no breakdown or cancellation of any of the great social gains which we have made in these past years. We have carried on an offensive on a broad front against social and economic inequalities, against abuses which had made our society weak. That offensive should not now be broken down by the pincers movement of those who would use the present needs of physical military defense to destroy it.
Yeah, the pincher movement. And he continues, he talks about specifically the minimum wage.
There is nothing in our present emergency to justify a lowering of the standards of employment. Minimum wages should not be reduced.
This is from FDR's Fireside Chat in 1940. And of course, the present emergency being the Great Depression and the looming war. I mean, there was and he continues at that point we were in the war. As we're in war, there will be no new war millionaires, Franklin Roosevelt says.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad. The American people will not relish the idea of any American citizen growing rich and fat in an emergency of blood and slaughter and human suffering.
So, you know, Pearl Harbor was in December 7, 1941. This was before Pearl Harbor. And yet still, I mean, you can see the direction. And he pointed out that the conservatives would trash these kinds of things. They would say, well, you know, you got a problem with war millionaires and you got a minimum wage. How can we have a minimum wage? We can't have that. And Roosevelt said, no, I'm sorry. This is poison. This is a poison in our society, an actual poison.
There is an added technique for weakening a nation at its very roots, for disrupting the entire pattern of life of a people. And it's important that we understand it. The method is simple. First, discord. The dissemination of discord. A group, not too large, a group that may be sectional or racial or political, is encouraged to exploit its prejudices through false slogans and emotional appeals.
Sound familiar?
The aim of those who deliberately egg on these groups is to create confusion of counsel, public indecision, political paralysis, and eventually a state of panic.
Yeah, indeed. And that, you know, a few names come to mind. He continued talking about the public poison.
Campaigns of group hatred or class struggle have never made much headway among us and are not making headway now. But new forces are being unleashed. Deliberately planned propagandas to divide and weaken us in the face of danger as other nations have been weakened before. These dividing forces, I do not hesitate to call undiluted poison. They must not be allowed to spread in the New World as they have in the old. Our moral, our mental defenses must be raised up as never before against those who would cast a smokescreen across our vision.
And to some extent, he was speaking of anti-Semitism as well, which, you know, was exploding in Europe at the time. But anyhow, wages, back to the minimum wage, which was a piece of this, and I kind of went off on a digression with Roosevelt there, but I could listen to Franklin Roosevelt all day long. But he brought us the minimum wage, and as you just heard, he was defending it 2 years after it was put into place in 1938. And when wages go up, what happens, and you see this all across the United States in every state where the minimum wage has been increased, when wages go up, then demand goes up. Because people who spend most of their money, which is most of us, spend most of our money on stuff. You know, the savings rate in the United States right now is actually negative. I mean, people are saving nothing. The average person is saving nothing. They're spending all of their money. So you give them a little more money, what do? They spend it. And that creates demand for product. It literally stimulates the economy. The problem is, if wages don't go up at the same rate that productivity goes up, then that disequilibrium will cause the economy to be thrown out of balance. That's not a good thing. And in fact, if the minimum wage had kept track with productivity, just since 1968, the average hourly wage right now would be $24.65 rather than the average, or actually in 2000 rather than $13.74. The minimum wage would have been $13.80, not $5.15 that it was in 2000. And right now it would be significantly above that. It would be around $15, the minimum wage, if it had simply kept up with productivity since 1968. So if wages don't keep up with productivity, two things happen. As an economy, we have to figure out how can we cause people to buy more stuff, even if they don't have more money. Because otherwise, you're not going to have an economy that works. And number two, if the productivity gains are not going to the workers, where are they going? These are the two great questions that people have to get. I mean, these are really essential things. And the simple answer is that when wages don't go up along with productivity, then what Alan Greenspan did, and this is what Reaganomics was all about, and this war on the middle class in the 1980s, they said, we're going to stop the growth of wages. We're going to bust labor unions. They started with PATCO. And instead, we're going to lower the cost of money. We're going to make credit more easily available. We're going to do away with the laws that restrain credit card companies from offering credit cards, multiple credit cards to people. We're going to make it easier to borrow. We're going to drop interest rates. We're going to create, but we're going to cause people to go into debt. In 1980, when Reagan started this, we were nearly at a peak of home ownership in the United States. Most people had significant equity in their homes. Of car ownership, most people had a car that they owned a good chunk of. The average loan on a car was 2 to 3 years maximum. Almost nobody was leasing cars. Everybody was buying a car. They keep them for 5 or 10 years. You know, a good chunk of Americans owned their car. People had savings accounts. People had equity. And the cons said, we're going to take all of that equity from the middle class. We're going to let them borrow their way into maintaining their lifestyle, and we're going to take the money.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now play something country.
21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, just to lay this thing out, today is the day that the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, is going up by 70 cents. And the history of the minimum wage, it was started in 1938 by Franklin Roosevelt. Historically, when wages track productivity, in other words, if productivity of an economy over a 50-year period or a 10-year period, if the productivity of the average worker goes up 20%, and the wages go up 20%, then the economy is in balance. The CEOs are making the same amount. Their wages go up 20%. The workers' wages go up 20%. The economy grows by 20%. Productivity goes up. It's a healthy, happy economy, as it were. But if the productivity goes up that 20% during that 10-year period and wages don't go up at all, then, number one, where does the money go? The extra money, that extra 20% of the money, where does that go? Well, that goes to CEOs. CEO pay, for example, in 1980, when Reagan came into power, the average CEO made 97 times what the minimum wage was. When Bush came into office, the average CEO made 1,200 times what the minimum wage was. And now it's around 1,600 times what the minimum wage is. So, number one, when wages don't increase, CEO wages suck up that extra, the money left over from that extra productivity. CEO wages and dividends that the corporations pay out to their wealthy stockholders. But principally CEO wages. For example, William McGuire, United Healthcare, the guy who made $1.78 billion over his last 10 years. That company, I believe, has around 35,000 employees. If his pay had been dropped from $1.78 billion down to $1 million, so over a 10-year period, he's making $200,000 a year, and I think you could probably get somebody to work as a CEO for $200,000 a year plus perks. Or even $1 million a year. If he was making $1 million a year during that period, over a 10-year period, make $10 million. Instead of $1.78 billion, the 35,000 employees of United Healthcare could each have made $5,000 a year more for every one of those 10 years. So those employees, as productivity went up, they didn't see that extra $5,000 a year. It went into Bill McGuire's pocket. And over the 30-year war on the middle class, wages have not gone up other than CEO wages. Which raises this weird thing. If wages don't go up, demand should have fallen. In other words, the economy should have collapsed. We should have slid into the Great Depression. Why didn't we? Well, because they made credit more readily available. Why? To destroy the middle class. This was the conservative plan from the get-go. They were actually quite open about it in their writings. I quote a number of them in my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. From Alan Greenspan on down. Why? Because they felt that an empowered middle class, and they thought the 1960s and the 70s were the proof of it, an empowered middle class where the majority of the people, at least half the labor force, had a good, solid job, they were represented by a union, they had a pension, they had health insurance, they felt safe, they could put their kids through college, they could raise a family on a single income, they owned at least half the equity in their home, they owned their car, they had savings. That family felt safe enough to go out and protest in the streets the war in Vietnam. Their kids felt safe enough to be the flower power generation. Women felt safe enough to go out into the workplace and say, no, we want equal rights. African Americans felt safe enough to say, we want equal rights. Gays were coming out and say, we want equal rights. The whole thing, and to the conservatives, this looked like a society in meltdown. And what they wanted to do was take us back to the era of Dickens with poor houses and no middle class other than the small mercantile middle class and professional middle class, where essentially the only middle class that was left would be the doctors and the lawyers and the local small shop owners. And they've even been wiping out the local small shop owners with monopoly capitalism. And so what we're seeing is that because 30 years ago, most middle-income people owned a chunk of their homes, owned their cars, had no debt, no credit card debt, none in the 1970s on average in America, and had savings account and pensions. Now, 30 years later, all that has been replaced by massive debt. The average American is massively in debt on all levels. But that's the only way they've been able to continue spending to drive the demand that's kept the economy going. And now it seems like we're at the end of the ability of the average American to tap their debt. One of two things has to happen. Either we have to raise their wages significantly, raise the minimum wage to $15 or $20 an hour. Do what Roosevelt did in 1938, make the minimum wage an actual living wage, or watch this country slide into a hyperinflationary recession or even a depression. And I believe that the conservatives running this country have opted for the latter, and they're trying to hold it off until Barack Obama becomes president, and then they're going to pull the plug and let it go. Then they're going to take their fingers out of the dike and let it go. And it's going to blow up. And the Democrats are going along with this in Congress because they get it, that a lot of people are in pain. So they're like, okay, we'll try and stop their pain. We'll try and hold it up. What they don't realize is they're creating a potential political disaster for the Democratic Party. Republicans are laughing all the way to the bank.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at 866-303-2270.
Not be pretty, and my clothes are not the best, and there ain't no big shots in my family tree. But if you're wondering who it was that made this country great, you don't have to look no further, it was me. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track, I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars, and I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
Yeah, 34 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Stephen in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'd like to say that I'm originally from Lansing, Michigan, and I do remember you on WITL.
Oh, cool. You're dating yourself, Stephen. That was long ago and far away. Well, thank you. What's up?
Sure. I've lived in cities where they've had, like, increases in minimum wage, like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the interesting point. I found that after whenever they had, like, a major increase in the minimum wage,
right.
Guess what? They raised the rent for us folks who live, like, within a certain amount where we have to pay out for rent every month. They mm-hmm. jack up the rent. It's a very interesting coincidence. You know what I'm saying?
Well, the rents are, you know, particularly in large metro areas that are geographically circumscribed. You know, like San Francisco is basically, you know, there's water all largely all around you, and there's no place else to go. L.A., you can kind of sprawl out. But, but I don't, you know, I think that the problem is that the minimum wage increases have not been enough to compensate for this, for the growth of the economy. They haven't been enough to compensate for the increase in productivity. They're not appropriate. Our minimum wage right now, if it had been keeping up with worker productivity, should be in the neighborhood of $15 to $16 an hour. And at $15 to $16 an hour, a person should be able to live, you know, ideally, maybe frugally, but should be able to live in most parts of America. And if you're suggesting that we should have rent control, I think that instead we should have we should be considering, you know, subsidizing low-income housing.
Well, that's what I'm on right now. That's why I'm able to live here in Santa Fe, because the rents here are very high. So I'm fortunate to have a involvement with HUD. So I feel that unless you have that type of arrangement, you can't really – I'm a single man. And really, if you're a single person making minimum wage, you really cannot move into a decent apartment, whether it's in Santa Fe or Los Angeles or San Francisco, because even if the minimum wage gets – you know, from $15 to $20 an hour, you know, like in San Francisco and other places like that, you really can't move into a decent place unless $1,500 a month, because anything less, it's already been taken up. So you either have to know somebody who is moving out or a building manager that has a vacancy. It's just it's a matter of availability. Yeah.
The problem and, that, you know, Stephen, I get it. And thank you for the call. The problem here with all of this is that we have doubled the population of the United States in the last, 40, 50 years or so. I mean, as there are simply more people, so there's more demand for living space. You know, not to mention the fact that there have been these bubbles in the housing market, and so housing has gone up. But, I mean, it's absolutely crazy that you've got teachers and police officers, for example, who can't afford to live in the communities that they serve. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. We have to figure out a way to do that. And I think, frankly, number one, roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Forget about the Bush tax cuts. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Take us back to a 71% top minimum wage, top maximum, if you're earning over $3.2 million a year, you start paying a 71% tax rate on everything after $3.2 million a year. Period. Bring that back. It worked just fine under Johnson, under Nixon, under Carter, under Eisenhower, under Kennedy. I mean, it worked just under Truman, under Truman and Roosevelt and Eisenhower. It was 91%, and it worked quite well, thank you very much. And we didn't see the United States plunging into debt, and you didn't see the middle class being wiped out. So. You know, there you go. That would be number one. And number two, raise the minimum wage to a reasonable minimum wage. And I believe that, or tie the minimum wage to productivity, or tie minimum wage to CEO wages. And by simply regulating the mechanism of wages through taxation and through a minimum wage, I think everything else in the economy, which frankly I don't think the government should be largely participating in, will begin to rebalance itself, as we saw in the 50s and 60s and 70s as a consequence of these changes that Roosevelt made. Jay in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jay.
Hey there, Tom. I think that the people ran up their debt purchasing frivolities, and they didn't really have to do that. And it kind of really bummed me out that the people really could have a lot more power if they just thought a little bit better.
Yeah, we've lost the value of frugality, but in part, and I agree with you, and this is, I don't know if you caught my rant yesterday about David Brooks' column. David Brooks, actually, the conservative columnist for the New York Times, nailed this quite well. He said, you know, on the one side, you've got, quote, liberals who are saying, oh, it's all society's fault because society has been encouraging people to buy, and on the third hand, you've got people saying, oh, it's all the conservatives' fault because they passed legislation that deregulated banking and credit and made it easier and easier for people to basically tie into something that could be addictive, you know, the ability to buy without immediate apparent consequence. And then you've got the liberals out there saying, well, you know, I guess actually that would be in David Brooks's mind, the liberal position. And, you know, that the conservatives did this to them. And the conservatives saying, well, it's just the individual responsibility. But I told the story of the squirrels. They did this study, you know, this was 20 years ago, where they took the red squirrels, as I recall, and they increased the size of one particular squirrel's nest by about 20%. What they found was all the other squirrels in the neighborhood, in their nests, they added more leaves to their nest. They made their nests larger. We have this biological, it's genetic, it's wired into us to keep up with the Joneses. And in the 50s and 60s and 70s on television, the Joneses, by and large, I mean, Ralph Cramden lived in a fourth floor of Coldwater walk-up apartment. And, you know, the Jackie Gleason show, Laura, you know, and Mary Tyler Moore and the Mary Tyler Moore show or the Dick Van Dyke show. I mean, they lived in a small middle-class apartment where he had to commute into New York City from way out in, you know, rural Long Island or something, because that's where they could afford to live. And we showed the middle class being the middle class. And then in the 80s, when Reagan came along and the celebration was wealth and the new heroes were the rich, suddenly all the homes became the homes of, you know, who's that TV psychiatrist, you know, where he and his brother are living in this million-dollar apartment, you know, and everybody's living in multi-million-dollar houses. And that became, and it's everybody's watching this, it became the new norm. And this biological thing kicked in at the same time that that the credit laws were changed to allow everybody to do that. So I think that there's three variables here. You have, you know, the societal variable. You've got the change in the laws variable. You've got the biological variable, and then you've got the individual responsibility variable, and we have to consider all of them.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Jay. I appreciate the call. I think that, you know, scapegoating any one particular group, say, oh, it's all the conservatives' fault, or it's all, you know, the failure of individual responsibility. I think all of those are far too simplistic. We have to look at this systemically. Anyhow, Jim in San Francisco. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, hi, Tom. from the city of San Francisco, where we have the highest minimum wage in the country, and with a built-in escalator clause.
Cool.
That keeps pace with inflation, so the workers don't have to keep coming back and begging every time they want an increase. And the Dems have yet to enact that at the federal level.
Yeah.
And the city of instant runoff voting, so that we can get rid of the spoiler problem and lesser evil voting and vote for who we want.
Yep, San Francisco's done a lot of things right.
Yeah, and that's the work of Matt Gonzalez.
Yep.
Who is running with Nader this time.
Yep.
But the reason I called is because I wanted you to expand, if you would, on what you said yesterday about Freddie Mac was privatized by LBJ.
Right.
In order to hide the costs of the Vietnam War, taking it off the books. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, he wasn't trying to hide the cost of the Vietnam War. That was a misstatement. He was trying to hide the deficit that was being caused by the Vietnam War and the growth of the federal budget, which, you know, there was this considerable criticism for it. The same way that Reagan was trying to figure out in 1982, he was trying to figure out how to compensate, or maybe it was 83, how to compensate for the collapse in federal tax revenues that came about with his tax cut. And so he started borrowing from the Social Security Fund and putting that money into the general fund, and it reduced the deficit without showing up as a liability. It didn't show as a debt, even though it was. And similarly, LBJ was looking for a way to generate money, to bring money into the federal coffers that could compensate for this incredible increase in costs associated with the war in Vietnam and the Great Society, actually, at the same time, but largely the war in Vietnam. How could he bring in some cash to compensate for that? And one way to do it was to take Freddie Mae and Fannie and Freddie and sell stock in them, sell billions and billions of dollars in stock in them. And it would, on the one hand, take some of those liabilities off the books of the government, off the government books, because they're no longer government agencies, they're now private agencies. And number two, a whole bunch of money came into the federal treasury over a short period of time in 1968 as a result of it. And so that's what happened. And Freddie and Fannie now are, you know, you've got the worst of both worlds. You've got private owners, the private stockholders, getting the benefit from them to the extent that they do with dividends, and on which they pay a maximum 15% income tax. And you've got us, the taxpayers, you know, bailing them out when they're badly managed. And you got the CEOs making millions. Thanks, Jim.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Taking my country back. Boys, you ain't been doing it right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq.
Yep, one congressional district at a time, one House district at a time, one state district at a time, one senator, one dog catcher, right across the board. We are taking our country back. And today with us, Daniel Biss. He's an assistant professor of mathematics at the University of Chicago, volunteers as a math teacher at the North Lawndale College Preparatory High School, charter school on Chicago's west side. A seasoned grassroots organizer, Daniels coordinated political campaigns throughout the area. He's the co-chair of the Illinois Committee of 100. The Illinois Carry Travelers help progressive candidates on both state and federal levels in their fight to make substantive change. Here's your opportunity to help a local, to help a candidate, a progressive candidate, achieve local office. Daniel Biss, B-I-S-S, danielbiss.com, the website. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you with us. Tell us about the seat you're running for state representative.
Well, it's the 17th district of Illinois. It's a north suburban Chicago district, and it's interesting. It's a very Democratic district. John Kerry got about 59% here, and we're expecting Barack Obama to get well over 60. And it's not just a Democratic district. It's a progressive district, much of it represented in U.S. Congress by Jan Schakowsky, a true leader of the anti-war movement, a true leader on working people's issues, and it's a district that I think ought to have the kind of grassroots progressive leader that so many of us in the country want for our nation.
Right, and Jan Schakowsky representing at the federal level in the U.S. Congress. You're running for the state as a state representative in Illinois, and these are really important races and really important seats. This is number one, a lot happens at the state level, and number two, most of our federal politicians started as state politicians, Barack Obama, case in point. Who's got the seat right now?
Well, it's a seat held by a Republican incumbent whose name is Elizabeth Colson. She's been in for a bit over a decade, and she's managed to hang on in this, again, very Democratic district by being a somewhat moderate Republican. She's pro-choice, for instance. But the argument that we've been making in this campaign is that, you know, in the current political climate, with the Republican Party headed the direction it's been headed, and with the country headed the direction it's headed, having someone who's just somewhat moderate isn't really good enough, particularly for a very strongly Democratic and very progressive district like this one.
Yeah. I'd say even having moderate Democrats isn't good enough, frankly.
I couldn't agree with you more there.
Yeah, you know, we need to be electing progressive. I mean, this is Bernie Sanders every Friday. He's like, don't just elect Democrats. Elect progressive Democrats. We're talking with Daniel Biss. Daniel, B-I-S-S, DanielBiss.com is his website. He is running for state house in 17th district in the Illinois House of Representatives. Daniel, some of the issues that you're looking at. And by the way, let me encourage our listeners to get over to your website, danielbiss.com, and to toss a few bucks your way. Tell us some of the issues that you're working on.
Well, you know, as you mentioned, I teach math right now down at the University of Chicago. Obviously, education policy is a huge thing for me. And one thing we talk a lot about here in Illinois is that we rank, and this surprises a lot of folks, we rank 49th in the country in state support of public education.
You're kidding.
Which is pretty astonishing for a fairly affluent and state which thinks of itself as a progressive, forward-thinking state. And so that's a tremendous problem for our state. Another issue that I find myself talking about again and again is the opportunity Illinois has to be a real national leader on environmental policy, on vehicle emission standards, on reducing our reliance upon coal for electricity. These are things that Illinois, as a large and, again, fairly wealthy state in the middle of the country, has an opportunity to take real national leadership on. Yeah. And instead, we've kind of been sitting behind and waiting for someone else to go first.
Yeah. So these are the things that you would be championing in the state house, Daniel Biss.
Absolutely.
And your background for this, as a teacher, I guess, you know, you're a competent, knowledgeable guy. But what caused you, or you can answer the background question if you prefer, what caused you to decide to run for the 17th District House of Representatives in Illinois?
Well, you know, obviously, as you alluded to, in the whole history of math teachers, no one ever went into that profession expecting to wind up running for political office, and I was certainly no different. I just found, you know, early in the Bush administration, I got so frustrated and so upset with the direction things were going in the country that I felt that I was unable to just keep on solving math problems and feel satisfied. I had to do something to get involved and began doing a lot of grassroots organizing across the northern suburbs of Chicago for a number of candidates, some federal, including John Kerry and some congressional candidates, but also some local candidates. And I really came to feel that, from my point of view, the core problem that causes so much of the other troubles in our society is real lack of engagement at the grassroots level in our political process. People feel so turned off, so excluded from the political process, that they then eventually stop participating. And so I wanted to take my involvement to the next level by running myself a campaign for local or state office, which would be very, very grassroots, which would build a really engaged base of local supporters, of course, first with the idea of winning the election, but then with the idea of going into office with a strong, strong active grassroots progressive base of people behind me who will then make it possible for me to function as a genuine progressive in the legislature, not just fall back on the same kind of fairly moderate and fairly pro-corporate policies that we see so much of.
Right. What? Give me a sense of the state house in Illinois. I mean, what percent? What's the ratio of Democrats to Republicans, and what's the ratio among the Democrats of progressives to moderates and conservative Democrats?
You know, Illinois is a really interesting case study of how a political model can be quite different from the federal one. Democrats control Illinois from top to bottom. We hold every single statewide elective office. Democrats have a veto-proof majority in the state Senate, and they're close to a veto-proof majority in the state House.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they're truly unable to get progressive legislation passed, truly yes. unable. And that's partially because progressives aren't really in control of the state party at all, mm-hmm. and it's partially because there's an old, old tradition of machine politics
yeah.
in Illinois and Chicago. And,
this is
and
the Mayor Daley syndrome. Yeah.
Yep, and there's still a big piece of the state party that's taken over by that culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, a big opportunity presented by this race is to empower another grassroots-backed progressive candidate who's not going to be a part of that machine culture that we've seen cause so much trouble in the state of Illinois.
There you go. So if you, dear listener, would like to be part of the solution to helping help flip Illinois more progressive, Daniel Biss, B-I-S-S, DanielBiss.com. The website, get over there and help him out. Daniel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a great honor, Tom.
Good talking to you. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you starting at the third hour of our program. Just a quick reminder, in a week from tomorrow, I'll be in Madison, Wisconsin. Well, it's Saturday, actually, is the main gig. August 2nd and 3rd, Madison, Wisconsin, with our affiliate station, the Mike 92.1 WXXM. I'm speaking Saturday at the Nonstop Radio Symposium in the Exhibition Hall at the Alliant Energy Center, nonstopradio.com, for more information about that. On August 16th, I'll be in Seattle, AM 1090 Progressive Talk 1090, KPTK. I'll be speaking at from 6:30 to 7:30, along with a whole bunch of other great progressive hosts at the Seattle Center Exhibition Hall. And speaking of Seattle, by the way, happy birthday to Millie Munger, who listens every day to Talk 1090. She's turning 90 years old today. Good on you, Millie, and thanks for listening to the show for all these years. And I'll be on Radio Row at both the Democratic and Republican conventions with our affiliates AM 760, Colorado's progressive voice in Denver, and in Minneapolis with AM 950, KTNF, the voice of Minnesota. Barack Obama in Berlin. Ich bin Berliner? No, wir alles bin Berliners. And I'm sure my German is, es tut mir leid für meine Schleckstrassendeutsch. Anyhow, here he is, Barack Obama in Berlin.
These are the aspirations that join the fates of all nations in this city. These aspirations are bigger than anything that drives us apart. It is because of these aspirations that the airlift began. It is because of these aspirations that all free people, everywhere, became citizens of Berlin. It is in pursuit of these aspirations that a new generation, our generation, must make our mark on the world. People of Berlin and people of the world, the scale of our challenge is great. The road ahead will be long. But I come before you to say that we are heirs to a struggle for freedom. We are a people of improbable hope, with an eye towards the future, with resolve in our heart. Let us remember this history and answer our destiny and remake the world once again. Thank you, Berlin. God bless you. Thank you. Thank you.
And the crowd went nuts. That was one heck of a speech. Barack Obama in Berlin, and I've not seen crowd estimates yet. Looking at the video of it, it looks pretty big. He was speaking at the Tiergarten. My recollection is, we've been to Berlin a few times. I thought the Tiergarten was, I thought that is German for animal garden. That was the zoo. But the article in the New York Times says it's the sort of Central Park of Berlin. So maybe I'm misremembering misremembering my poor German. But anyhow, Barack Obama doing that. And in the meantime, John McCain, of course, he's got to do his piece in this. John McCain has to play catch up. And so John McCain, in response to Barack Obama showing up in Berlin to thousands of screaming Berliners, went to a German restaurant in German Village, Ohio, where he ordered sauerkraut bratwurst balls, Hofbräu schnitzel, and bratwurst. And I don't know, maybe 20 people showed up or something. it's almost tragic. It's almost tragic. It's getting kind of sad to see John McCain. I mean, he gets his facts wrong about Iraq. He can't remember when the escalation began. He forgets that the Sunni so-called awakening, where we paid them not to shoot at us, or they came to us and they said, "You pay us and we won't shoot at you," started long before, months before there was even any discussion of an escalation, the so-called surge. And now he's saying, "Oh no, that was part of the surge. You don't get it." And he's trying to redefine terms. And yesterday he even canceled any kind of press availability because he's got this thing all scrambled. And he's running ads now with his latest TV ad has got Barack Obama and Fidel Castro in the same ad. I really hope Americans don't fall for this. I mean, it would be such a tragedy. John McCain is running this campaign of be afraid, be afraid. And we have had politicians in the past who have tried to run similar campaigns, and we've had politicians who have said, no, we're not a fearful people. John McCain is running a campaign saying, give up your rights. It was a fine thing. Let us wiretap you. Well, Obama voted for that, too. But he's not running on it. In fact, I think he's going to be running away from it. But nonetheless, McCain's, yes, we're right there with George W. Bush, and, it's the war on terror, And be afraid, be afraid. I played for you earlier a couple of short clips of Franklin Roosevelt. This is just a couple of words. This is only 20 seconds that he had to say about the politics of fear.
It is first of my...
Let me turn the volume down here a little bit first. I had to turn it way up to get that Obama video. Here it is.
It is whispered by some that only by abandoning our freedom, our ideals, our way of life, can we build our defenses adequately? Can we match the strength of the aggressors? I did not share those illusions. I do not share these fears.
So there you go. We're not going to be a fearful people. We're not going to be a fearful people. I mean, this is Franklin Roosevelt. He just wrapped it up very nicely.
Today we are more realistic. But not let us not be calamity howlers and discount our strength. Let us have done with both fears and illusions.
Amen. Amen. And it's time, frankly, in my opinion, for us to right across the board have done with fear and illusions. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com, our websites. Cliff in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hey, Will. Hey, Cliff. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I love your show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about this class warfare topic that seems to just never, ever go away.
Yeah. Well, that's because the class warfare has never gone away.
Yeah. Well, what it seems to me is that the whole crux of it is that when you have a comfortable and thriving middle class, they want to become a player in their political and economic future.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be exactly what the modern-day Carnegies and Vanderbilts resent the most, almost more than sharing the wealth, is the fact that we want a piece of the political action.
Yeah. Well, that was my point, is that, you know, I mean, you go back, Alan Greenspan, I have the actual quote in Screwed in my book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, told the Wall Street Journal in, as I recall, 97, I don't have it in front of me, but he said that his job as chairman of the Fed, one of his principal jobs as chairman of the Fed, was that whenever the economy got hot enough, got, you know, rolling enough, that people started demanding wage increases, he would increase interest rates to slow down the economy so that people would be thrown out of work. And he said that his job was to maintain a certain, and this is his phrase, minimum threshold of worker insecurity.
That's unbelievable.
I mean, they're at least they're honest about it, you know?
I don't understand why they want to abandon such a convenient market. Why don't they want to keep selling the refrigerators and their stupid...
Oh, they do. They just want us to go in debt to buy them, you know? But the problem is that we're all, you know, that so much of America now doesn't have any equity at all. I mean, it used to be that many America, a large chunk of America, actually owned a lot of equity in their homes. And now they don't. It used to be that a lot of America owned equity in their cars. Now they don't. It used to be that a lot of America had some credit worthiness. Now the average American is $7,900 in debt to the credit card companies. I mean, we are reaching, not only have they taken all of our equity, all of our assets, but now they've driven us into debt to the point where most Americans, you know, the day of reckoning, we're standing at the edge of it, Cliff.
Well, I don't feel too sorry then for General Motors and the rest of them. I don't. Because the economic ruin seems to be a nonpartisan affair. I mean, at some point, you know.
Yeah, I'm not sure what GM did to bring this about. I would say that this is, and you know, not certainly GM, as like every large corporation, has its share of corporate sins. But I would say that the problem is, and just like I, you know, Walmart. I mean, I can find a lot of things to criticize about Walmart, but the problem isn't Walmart. The problem is laws that allow Walmart to do what they do. You know, it's the lack of regulation. It's the lack of enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act. It's the lack of enforcing zoning laws. It's Supreme Court decisions that say, and Cliff, thanks for the call. It's Supreme Court decisions that say corporations are persons, and therefore they, you know, if you try to keep a Walmart out of your community, that's the same thing as trying to keep an African American away from a lunch counter in a Kreskies. I mean, this because of the 14th Amendment, because we've given them personhood rights. I mean, it's just, which is, by the way, a position that John Roberts made a career defending.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I've heard that other countries are down on the U.S. a land of mass consumption, our lives filled with excess. But my daddy wasn't fighting on Normandy that day for the right to drive a Hyundai. I refuse to live that way, and I'm proud to be an American who gets just 5 mpg. Though I live alone, the car I own can seat 103, and I'll gladly park so close to you when you pull out you can't see. No, I'll never trade my Escalade. God bless my SUV.
Yeah. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ed in Hillsboro. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. How's that little kitten of yours?
The little kitten is great, and I think we've pretty much decided that we're going to call her Fang, or him, rather. And,
Fang, that's a good name.
Yeah, so Louisa's got a track back, and we've got to figure out who first suggested that name, and we're going to send him a copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and what we can do about it.
Fantastic. Hey, I was hoping to link up the discussion from the first hour with the one on the second a little bit. And basically, rather than using public money to further the schemes of someone like T-Bone Pickens, who really already has more money than it's healthy to permit one man to have in a democracy, What we should be doing instead is looking to solve our energy problems and our other national problems in ways that help rebuild the capital of the middle class. And what I mean by that is, like, instead of building a bunch of infrastructure that would help Mr. Pickens exercise monopoly over the supply of electricity, what we should do is subsidize individual mom-and-pop homeowners to install solar collectors and windmills on their property that they could then generate power, sell it back to the grid. It becomes an income-producing asset for middle-class people. And I think that that's really where we need to be looking. And we need to look with a jaundiced eye at when some rich man rides up on a horse and says, I'm going to solve all your problems for you.
Well, this is the problem, because government in Texas and government across the United States, 30 years now of conservative rule, has failed to make those changes. Jimmy Carter got us going down that road. And when Reagan, you know, with his solar bank that was going to have 20% of all our electricity in the United States being produced by solar power by the year 2000, we now know if we had followed what he started, we'd be actually way ahead of that. But Reagan came in and rolled all that back. And so when you have a situation where somebody like T. Boone Pickens comes in and says, okay, I got a pile of money, and I can make a bigger pile of money by putting up windmills, it actually, I mean, there is a public good that is served by that. And I, at some point as a society, we have to say, you know, how much, you know, it's like, here's the flip side of it, Ed. Mm. What if you and I what if we lived in the same community? I mean, we more or less do. I mean, you're in Hillsboro, Oregon. Portland and environs decided that we were all going to put solar collectors on our roofs, and or just an individual. Just say you decided you were going to put a solar collector on your roof and you were going to generate more electricity than you could use, and you started selling it to your neighbors. I mean, there, should we forbid that? Do you want to forbid free enterprise?
It has to do with, we need to think in multiple levels at the same time. We can't just think linear, one problem, one solution. But, if I'm a smallholder, if I'm mom and pop middle class, then a solution that solves the energy problem by providing a new source of energy and also helps me to regain some ground in terms of having sufficient capital to support myself. I mean, that's the traditional, historic meaning of middle class. Before it took on its cultural meaning that we have today, it was somebody that owned enough property to support themselves. And, you weren't a serf, you weren't a peasant, you weren't somebody that was beholden to somebody, a sharecropper. You actually owned the means to make your own survival possible. And we need to be thinking multiple lines of problem at the same time and multiple solutions at the same time. Not just, we don't have enough energy, but how do we...
No, I absolutely agree with you. And it ain't happening. I mean, you've got government not doing the things that need to be done. It should have been, the state of Texas. It should have been the Federal Department of Energy. Could have said, hey, there's 500 acres or whatever the size of the piece of land is that Pickens is buying in Texas, where there's, enormous wind blowing all the time. And if we put $500 million into turbines there, we'll be able to, over a period of time, produce a certain amount of energy. I mean, they should be doing that.
Well,
but
right. And the thing is that comes back to us, though. I mean, it's, the political process, propaganda is powerful, and the wealthy have control of most of the avenues of propagandizing, the public. But
right.
We have a responsibility to think for ourselves and to generate these ideas and get them in circulation, put them on the table whenever we can and say, hey, there's another way, and this is what we want.
Yeah.
And, we need to build a movement,
and we
need to get these ideas circulating so that everybody, so they're on the tips of everybody's lips.
Yeah, and public power should be a piece of it. It should absolutely be a piece of it. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, in fact, I'm looking at maybe doing a show here from Germany sometime this fall. I want to get over there and have Germans tell you about this extraordinary program where the government said, okay, we will provide, they essentially created a Fannie Mae for mortgages on solar panels on the roof of your house, 10-year mortgages, and, they're subsidized. I think it was a 2% interest rate. And then they also created a subsidy where the power companies had to pay 7 times the cost of the electricity for that same 10-year period to buy electricity back from you when it's generated. And those two amounts of money balanced out more or less. So the amount of money you're generating in generating electricity is about equal to your mortgage payments. At the end of 10 years, both subsidies go away, and the country's generating its own power now.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Under control here. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. 34 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270. Our phone number. Daryl in Michigan listening on WDTW. Hey, Daryl.
Hey. Good afternoon.
Thank
you. It's a very sunny day here in southeastern Michigan.
Well, that's great.
Nice.
That's great.
Nice.
I was there last weekend. You know, I was in Lansing all last weekend.
Yeah, it's a little warm, but it's nice. It's not raining.
Yeah.
I called in because I heard your show. I was on the radio, in the car on the radio, and you played a little snippet from Barack Obama's speech.
Right.
And I was curious about how it had gone, so I got online and actually read the text of the speech.
Mm-hmm.
And after 8 years of bizarro world.
Mm-hmm.
Bizarro Bush versus a candidate and then a usurper in chief. I was moved to tears.
Yeah.
This is so good. I'm not wanting to cast aspersions on him saying that he didn't write it, but I don't know if any major candidate does not have the help of speechwriters today. But whoever did this as a team, or even if he did this all by himself, this is a wonderful piece of prose.
Yeah,
that deserves to be read, and when you read it, you need to read it out loud to hear it. It sings, and it sings of hope and the end of fear.
Yeah.
And it's well worth your time and attention.
I absolutely agree with you, Daryl. I have the text of it right here in front of me, and I've read through most of it on the break, and it is an absolutely brilliant speech, and we heard, you know, the presentation at the tail end of it, the wrap up, the real crescendo there on the radio, and this man has the potential if we keep pushing him in the right direction. It takes a movement for a politician to become a statesman. He has the potential to be the synthesis of John Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt, and that's the hope we have to hold, and that's the direction we have to push him in. Daryl, I got to move along. Thank you very much for your call, and great to hear from you, and spot on. Deborah in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Deborah.
Hi. We've spoken before, but as far as the 55-mile-an-hour thing goes,
yeah,
I think it's kind of a no-brainer. But moreover than anything else, and the reason that I'm saying that it's a no-brainer for saving fuel,
right.
If anybody was paying attention this weekend and watched what was happening in Beijing, China, with them taking a million cars off the road by doing the odd-even thing with the license plates,
right.
It took them 3 days between that and shutting down, three power plants and closing down any unnecessary construction things to go from a sky that you couldn't see the tops of the buildings to a sky where you could see blue.
Right.
And I don't understand how people don't grasp the idea of, one, saving fuel, two, if the optimum burning rate, or if the cars are set up to do it at 55, and that's how and they best burn the fuel, then there's less junk going into the air.
Yeah, I agree, Deborah, and it's a good argument for a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. Thanks for the call, and thanks for making the point. Here's the other side of it, though. This is the point of how regulation affects these things. Cars are designed to have their maximum point of fuel efficiency at 55, because at 55 on a straightaway is the fuel measurement that is done, that is printed on that sticker on the side of the car and that they put in their advertisements of average highway gas mileage. Now, if the federal government simply said you will specify 65 as your federal highway gas mileage that you put on that sticker, they would redesign the engines and they would redesign the transmissions to be optimal at 65 and redesign the cars, frankly, with regard to wind, drag, and everything else. It's like with electronic things, UL, Underwriters Laboratories, the standards that are set by the federal government are that if you have a device that draws fewer than 50 watts, I think it is, then it doesn't have to have a UL certification. It doesn't have to have a certification that it's safe, that it's not going to burn your house down, it's not going to blow up. Because, you know, less than 50 watts, I mean, it's not drawing that much power. And so what happens is that in order to get devices, I may have my numbers wrong on the wattage, but in any case, in order to get devices below that level, what they do is they have these external power supplies. Oh, I remember now. If it has an internal power supply and it's under 50 watts, it still has to be rated. But if it has an external power supply, it doesn't. So what they do is they sell these external power supplies. So we've got all these parasitic power supplies plugged in all over the country. And if we simply banned those little transformers that plug into the wall that are continuously drawing electricity, even when the device that they're hooked up to isn't, that constitutes about 10% of all the electricity used in the United States is this parasitic power. And it's a relatively recent thing, and it's the result of this regulation that was put into place. And it's an example of how, you know, regulation gone wrong, you know. And we need to be looking at these things. There's a whole wide variety of things that we need to be looking at, frankly, in my opinion. Robin in L.A. Hey, Robin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, three things real quick. On the cat, I've been trying to get into the website to name the cat. And, it keeps sending me passwords, but none of them work. So I'm Bluesman in the chat room, by the way. The name that I came up for, it was Velcro.
Velcro. Yeah. He does attach himself to you.
I'm going to be coming up for that big thing there with KPTK.
That's great.
Bring you some smoked salmon that I smoked at home.
Oh, great. Great.
And on the cane. I think John's probably going to bow out. I think that the Republicans are going, John, you're embarrassing the hell out of us. Take a bow. Let's call it a medical thing or whatever. And
you know, I predicted that on this show about a month ago, that McCain would have sometime in late August or early September, probably, you know, sometime in late August, actually, he would have a small medical problem that would cause him to bow out, probably after he had selected a vice presidential nominee, who I think is going to be Mitt Romney, and then that person would become the presidential nominee, and he would have a vice presidential nominee in the wings just in time for the.
That's what I'm thinking, Tom. He's thrown so many gas out in the last week that it's just like you said, it's getting sad.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I agree. Robin, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And Norm in Portland, you want to correct my 55-mile-an-hour optimization. Am I wrong on that?
Yes. That was true 2007 and before.
Okay.
But for the 2008 model year, the EPA changed the procedures through which you establish highway city mileage.
Right.
And that speed limit within the EPA ratings is now up to 65.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they've already done that. So that means that the cars that are coming off the assembly line in 2008 have already been designed to have optimal fuel efficiency at 65?
Well, I can't swear that the vehicles have been changed that much.
Right.
The only thing I know for sure is that the EPA method of testing has changed for 2008.
That's very interesting. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out. Norm, thanks a lot for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. Dave in Nebraska, you get your best gas mileage at 90 miles an hour?
My wife's a big number cruncher, and she loves to keep track of the gas mileage, and several occasions that we get a chance to do actually that type of speed. Yes.
That's interesting. Sean Taylor, my producer, she loves to drive fast, and she's going, yeah!
Well, it's a 1999 Bonneville SSEI, and maybe it's the aerodynamics of the car or whatever. It doesn't look all that different than anything else produced at that time.
Yeah.
But it's a turbocharged V6, and absolutely, I gain 4 to 5 miles per gallon. At 90
miles an hour. That's amazing. Well, at that speed, you got so much air flying underneath the car, it's probably lifting you up off the road a little bit, and you've got a little less rubber on the road. Well, I don't know. I can't speculate, but that's fascinating. Dave, thanks a lot for that. Bob in San Francisco. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. We're in an environment where somebody might want to lose a war rather than an election. And
that's just such a scurrilous thing to say. I mean, it's such a slur.
Well, let's try it on Bush, because there have been two elections, and each time they're followed by somebody being defenestrated, in first case Powell and then Rumsfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And not until the election. And in the meantime, Talifar occurred before Powell was out. It demonstrated Thierhold's bill works. Condi championed it as soon as she was Secretary of State. Still didn't work for her because you couldn't throw Rumsfeld out, and he beat her back on it.
Mm-hmm.
He stayed 2 more years and slow walked the war. Finally, he leaves, but only after that election. So there's two elections, at least one of which Bush won by downplaying the war,
yeah.
Ignoring Condi, ignoring the lesson of Talifar, which McCain claims for the surge. He calls it clear bills. Etc.
Right.
The motto of the surge. That's a small 3-year chronological error that I don't really begrudge him, except you ought to notice it. He's using that formula about.
Yeah, interesting. Except the problem, Bob, is that he's claiming credit for it.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com. Of course, they're a superb website. Hey, Ellen.
Yes, I know you've been talking about Obama's speech. As you know, we sometimes have our correspondent in Europe, our flying correspondent, and a couple interesting things about the speech. One is, as I'm sure you may have already talked about, he does not mention Iraq once in the speech.
Right.
And secondly, he borrowed, of course, on the, when he talks about the history and talks about the wall and borrows a little bit from Ronald Reagan, but he actually also borrowed from LBJ when LBJ talks about first he is a free man and then he is a citizen of the United States. And Obama talks about being an American citizen and a fellow citizen of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That I thought was pretty interesting about. And then you juxtapose this speech with the speech the president today gave at the Ronald Reagan Center, where he again talks about pressure on the enemy, capturing and killing thousands of terrorists, removing the regimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. It really was a just 180-degree different speech than the president gave today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Several other things. Today, Dana Perino, it was Dump on Democrats Day at the White House. Dana.
When is it not?
Well, that's true, but today was double dump on Democrats. She said today that the Democrats wanted to turn off the Medicare trigger. It was passed in 2003, and then when Medicare spending apparently exceeds 45% of what the amount is. In the two consecutive trustee reports, the president is required to propose a plan to deal with this, but that Pelosi is now planning on doing away with the trigger. Well, okay, where's the president's plan? Even if she does away with the trigger, where's the president's plan?
Right.
And then she said, this was classic. They must have had a great writer. She said, it's the legislative equivalent of pulling out the fuse light in your car when the check engine light is flashing.
Well, that's strange.
I know. She just said that about an hour ago. She also said that Democratic rulers change the name of the game. Well, then she was asked about the unemployment this afternoon, which is, of course, at 406,000, the worst since September 2005 after Hurricane Katrina. And she said that some of this had been caused by rising headwinds, caused by rising gas prices, the housing crisis. And she said that unemployment remains low by historic standards, but, of course, that doesn't help individuals looking for a job. And then she talked about the Fannie Mae reforms stabilizing the market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, actually, you know, I think the Fannie Mae reforms are going to... I'm sorry. I think the Fannie Mae reform that I believe, you know, should be done is that we should renationalize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and put them back to what they originally were. You know, not-for-profit agencies that are working in a nice, dull, boring way in the background, keeping the mortgage market moving smoothly. But that ain't happening. So instead, you know, our tax dollars are being used to bail out a bunch of private investors.
I mean, I don't know where the White House is going with it. They're certainly making an awful lot of noise.
Well, they're trying to take credit for any kind of benefit that comes out of it and shift any blame on the Democrats. I mean, just like with everything else.
Not surprising.
Yeah.
Why am I not surprised? My favorite expression besides...
Exactly.
That's exactly. All right.
I love it when you say that.
All right. Well, today it looks like the Senate Democrats or the Senate tried to get the employment EPA information and from the EPA. Well, the Senate got in the way of that and tried to in terms of getting these subpoenas and other things going on. And so just in a very few minutes, Senator Patrick Leahy, actually it's just taking place now. It started a little late. But the Senate Judiciary Committee is now holding a presser on to say why did the administration get involved in trying to get the Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Stephen Johnson to not come before the committee and to why the White House is just stalling on all of this.
And what do you think is the answer?
Well, I think the White House just doesn't want him to have to testify under oath. Don't forget, you have had a lot of Republican, not a lot, but you've had some Republican appointees at the EPA say, we're out of here, and have begun talking.
Yeah.
And so, and even the Wall Street Journal has said that there is a complete fight between the EPA, Bush appointees, and the White House.
Right. And the politicization of carbon dioxide in particular. Here you got James Hansen from NASA saying, once we cross the 350 parts per billion threshold, we began to endanger the human species. We're now at 385 parts per million. And we crossed that threshold about a half a decade ago. And the Bush administration saying, oh, no, it's not a pollutant. There's nothing to worry about. You know, don't look behind that screen.
Well, I must say, Senator Obama understands the green because he certainly discussed that in his speech as well.
Yeah, he did. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you today. Tomorrow, of course, it wouldn't be Friday without our weekly Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls, your chance to talk with a U.S. Senator. Plus, anything goes Friday, and we're trying to track down Don Siegelman here, see if we can get him to drop by and let us know what's going on, the latest with his case. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it! Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great one.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.